This is The Best of Fair on the Faircast. This episode comes from the 2008 Fair Conference and is a talk delivered by Michael R. Ash entitled Shaken Faith Syndrome.
Mike Ash is the owner and operator of MormonFortress.com website and has spoken at 5 of the past 9 fair conferences. He has been published in Sunstone, Dialogue and the Farms Review, and is the author of Shaken Faith Syndrome, Strengthening One's Testimony in the Face of Criticism and Doubt. Just my own note that's not written in here. Mike, I like always listening to Mike because he's very clear-spoken, and his book has become one of my favorites, so I would really highly recommend you pick one up. With that, let me introduce Mike Ash.
Good morning. It's hard to believe that it's been a decade since the first fair conference took place. I've attended all of them except for the very first one in California, and they've been wonderful and have grown each time. For those of you that have been with fair for a while and maybe have attended the rest of the conferences, you know how the landscape has changed through the years, especially if you've been involved in apologetics before there was the internet, or LDS scholarly studies before the internet. You know, if you wanted to see an anti-Mormon movie, I remember going to see The Godmakers years ago, and I found out about it because an ad that was in the newspaper at a local evangelical church, and so I attended. And now, of course, you find anti-Mormon DVDs on your doorstep and on YouTube, and so there's a lot of changes that have taken place. You think, prior to the internet, how many members owned anti-Mormon literature? And there probably wasn't a lot. And now, you know, how many members that are doing research for a lesson or a talk stumble across it on the internet, and sometimes drawn in by curiosity? And it reminds me a little bit of the story of the man who was walking down the sidewalk, and he passed by in an insane asylum, and the yard of the insane asylum was fenced off with this tall wooden fence, so nobody could see in, nobody could see out. And as he walked by, he could hear voices chanting, 13, 13, 13, 13. It's like, what in the world is going on behind that fence? So he studied over the fence, and he saw a knothole. Bent down to look through that knothole, and suddenly a finger shot out, poked him in the eye. As he recoiled in pain and shock, he heard the voices chant, 14, 14, 14. And I think that's sometimes how it happens with some of the anti-Mormon literature. You know, what is this all about? And so you're kind of drawn into it. Title of the book that I've written, of course, is Shaken Faith Syndrome. If you don't like it, I'll take full blame. If you do like it, it's not my creation completely. There's so many people that have contributed to it, either with their comments or unknowingly sometimes. I've culled this information for many years from so many of you others that are out in this audience. And so, like I said, it's kind of a fair production. There are many reasons that people leave the church, and shaken faith seems to arise at least from two different scenarios. Typically, one of them would be that somebody loses their faith because of a death or some other catastrophe or calamity in their family. And I hear these stories periodically. How could God do this? And so they give up on their faith. Some people have their faith shaken because they're exposed to information that seems to question the truth claims of the church. And it's this category that I talk about in my book. Let's talk about the title, and I've got the syndrome italicized here. Some of the critics have taken exception to the use of syndrome in the title. They claim that most English-speaking Americans would understand the word to mean an illness or disease. Therefore, they suggest that I must mean that critics are mentally ill or that they have something wrong with them for not accepting the gospel. I've heard this complaint, and I was kind of astonished by hearing this, and I've only heard it from critics. In medicine, syndrome typically does refer to a disease or illness, such as autoimmune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS, or Down syndrome. But in psychology and in the modern vernacular, the term can refer to the response to extenuating circumstances such as the Stockholm Syndrome. Some of you might be familiar with this, where it's captives, in many times hostage situations, develop some sort of loyalty to their captor, and this is all theoretical, of course. Some people theorize that perhaps Elizabeth Smart felt something like this, and that's why she didn't come forward when she probably had some opportunity. And it's also China Syndrome. If you remember the 1979 movie, the term China Syndrome refers, in fact, it's only mentioned jokingly in the movie, that if an American nuclear plant were to melt down, it would melt all the way through the earth to China. So obviously neither one of these are diseases. From dictionary.com, which is obviously the main source for looking up any kind of word, we find four definitions. In pathology and psychiatry, syndrome means a group of symptoms that together are characteristic of a specific disorder, disease, the like. A group of related or coincident things, events, actions, etc. The pattern of symptoms that characterize or indicate a particular social condition, and a predictable characteristic pattern, behavior, action, etc., that tends to occur under certain circumstances. The retirement syndrome of endless golf and bridge games, the feast or famine syndrome of big business. Now, while the first definition refers to mental, or could refer to a disease or disorder, the three remaining ones don't, and they could apply or be used in the same way that I use in shaken faith syndrome. And we see that, of course, in number four, syndrome used in other ways. Now, the title, of course, shaken faith syndrome, is clearly a play on the problem of shaken baby syndrome, which should be, seems obvious. Now, shaken baby syndrome, again, is not a disease or an illness per se, but it's a problem caused by shaking an infant. And it's the resulting damage can mean death or some sort of disastrous change in the way the baby is able to behave or move or think because of the damage of the spinal cord. And the damage is caused by someone else, someone that either intentionally or unintentionally hurts or kills the child. Well, so likewise, LDS critical material can and has shaken the faith of Latter-day Saints. He has killed testimonies and has damaged testimonies to the point of near death. So I hope you can see why I chose that title, Shaken Faith Syndrome, to describe what's happening. Plus, I thought it was kind of a catchy title. What about doubt? Now, having doubt isn't a sin, and it's not abnormal. About 95% of Americans believe in God, but nearly half, including those who consider themselves to be religiously devout, seriously question your faith from time to time. The church umbrella, thankfully, is large enough to include those who struggle with sporadic or even chronic doubt. To some, revealed the Lord, it is given to know that Jesus is the Son of God. To others, it is given to believe on their words, that they might also have eternal life if they continue faithful. That's from DNC 46:13-14. Joseph F. Smith once said that Latter-day Saints are given the largest possible latitude for their convictions. And if a man rejects a message that I may give to him, but is still moral and believes in the main principles of the gospel and desires to continue in his membership in the church, he is permitted to remain. So long as a man believes in God and has little faith in the church organization, we nurture and aid that person to continue faithfully as a member of the church, though he may not believe all that is revealed. Why does doubt cause some to abandon their convictions and not others? It seems that those who are prone to fundamentalist, dogmatic, or closed-minded perspectives about the gospel or early LDS history are more likely to suffer from shaken faith syndrome when they encounter challenging issues. Now, I'd use the term fundamentalist in a way that may differ from other usages of the term. I'm not referring to Islamic terrorists. I'm not referring to modern-day polygamists. In Christianity, the term often refers to conservative evangelicals who actively affirm what they see as fundamental Christian beliefs, such as an inerrant Bible, a Bible that is literally interpreted and historically accurate despite any conflicting claims from science and modern scholarship. So by association, the term fundamentalist is also used to describe people of all religions, many times, who take a very rigid, uncompromising, and unchanging approach to their ideology or belief system. The definition that I use for closed-minded is kind of how I use in the book for fundamentalist. That's what I mean by it. Now, everybody, not just those that we would call maybe fundamentalists, have at least some rigid beliefs. all of us, if we were to examine everything we believe, there's some things that we really don't budge on or don't want to know any more about. So what happens when we encounter information that conflicts with our existing thoughts or maybe our actions? Well, we get an uneasy feeling. You ever had buyer's remorse? You buy something and you think about it and, gosh, I shouldn't have done that. Do you continue to live with buyer's remorse? Well, what do we typically do? We either return the product or we convince ourselves that we made the right decision. It was on sale, it's a good buy, I need this. In psychology, there's a phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance. Cognitions are thoughts, and dissonance means disharmony. So when thoughts are out of harmony, that's cognitive dissonance. And now sometimes we can have conflicting thoughts and not realize it, or we may realize it, but we're not troubled by it. When we recognize that we have competing cognitions, and when we are troubled by the conflict, we enter into a state of cognitive dissonance. And this creates a degree of intellectual, emotional, even physical discomfort. Now, and we take steps to alleviate this because we don't feel good about this. And that typically comes from talking ourselves out of the uneasiness. For example, most of us have been guilty at some point of speeding. If we're aware that we're speeding, it could create cognitive dissonance. So how do we reduce this? Well, we make up excuses. I'm short on time, and the meeting I have to attend is more important than the minor law that I'm breaking. Or the chances of getting caught are very slim. Or it's an open road, and so there's really nobody else out here. I'm not going to, you know, risk getting into an accident. I'm an experienced driver. Those are the types of things we do so we don't have this cognitive dissonance. How about if you're on a diet and your boss springs for pizza, but you love pizza. So you might say to yourself, well, there's vegetables, and vegetables are good. Or maybe I work out 3 days a week, or I already blew my diet this morning with a donut, so I might as well have pizza anyhow, or I'll restart Monday. Now, the level of discomfort that we feel is directly related to how important we perceive the issue to be. In the pizza example, we may not feel much uneasiness at all, and we may quickly resolve the cognitive dissonance. Let's suppose, however, that you're addicted to alcohol, drugs, or pornography. You know it's wrong, and when you engage in these addictions, you may really feel a lot of cognitive dissonance. And again, you either stop doing it or you talk to yourself why you continue with it. What if you discovered that you had assumptions about Joseph Smith's clothing styles, hair color, or pitch of voice? What if they were incorrect, those assumptions? Now, these aren't really important issues. They don't carry a lot of weight. So it's doubtful that discovering that you were wrong about these issues would create much emotion or turmoil. It probably would matter, however, if we discovered information that implied that Joseph Smith was a fraud or delusional, or that the Book of Mormon was merely fiction. Each person assigns different levels of importance or weight to their various beliefs, and the weight is typically influenced by a variety of factors. What we personally experience carries a lot of weight. If, for example, you had a stomach ache every time after you drank milk, your belief that milk wasn't good for you would carry a lot of weight. If you've noticed blessings every time you pay your tithing, that would carry a lot of weight with you. The source of the competing cognition, the conflicting one, also carries a lot of weight. Suppose your doctor told you to eat more popcorn for your digestive tract. You would more likely believe her than if the same advice came from the snack vendor at the movie theater. Likewise, active members of the church would be more likely to give credence to the counsel of church leaders on spiritual issues than they might give to pop psychologists or TV talk show hosts. When we encounter cognitive dissonance with weighty issues, such as religious beliefs, we can experience a very uncomfortable emotional state of mind. This discomfort has been called a negative drive state because it causes psychological tension, almost like hunger or thirst, and requires immediate attention and reduction. Reducing this stress might require a change in belief or behavior. There's four ways in which this is generally accomplished, and we do it usually unconsciously. We don't think about the options, we just kind of act on them. Number one, we might reject the new information, the competing cognition. Two, we reject the information as important. The first one we reject as false, the second one is unimportant. Three, we might reject the original belief and favor the new cognition. Or four, we might add information to the original cognition to validate the original belief. Some of you know Ben McGuire, and I don't think he's here today, but he's part of the FAIR list, and he gave a great example of how this cognitive dissonance works, and I use it in my book. Suppose you're playing with a red ball. The fact that you know the ball is red is a cognition. Then I come along and comment on how nice your green ball looks. You now have a second cognition, that I have the green ball. The two cognitions stem from contradictory states. That is, the ball is not both green and red. If the two cognitions are weighted equally, this might create cognitive dissonance, which is to say that if you valued my opinion as much as your own on determining the way you view reality, you would experience cognitive dissonance. So when we have important issues and we have these conflicting things in religion especially, this is kind of the process we go through. So let's examine how these four options work with the ball and then apply it to our own beliefs. Okay, the number one, reject the new information as false. So decide that I'm wrong when I claim the ball is actually green. I'm either lying or deluded or colorblind. We might reject anti-LDS information as false, believing instead that critics invented the claim or pulled the information out of context. By brushing stuff aside, we resolve any emotional discomfort. And that approach many times works because, you know, a lot of times it is pulled out of context or they've made it up. We might reject the new information as unimportant. We decide that the color of the ball is unimportant compared to the enjoyment of playing with it. Well, the same thing with our beliefs. We may decide that the new discovery is really unimportant compared to how we feel about the gospel, what's inside, our testimony. And that's, again, not necessarily a bad thing. That spiritual testimony can carry more weight than the sources that we don't necessarily trust or fully understand. So we might put them aside, put them on the shelf. Now, both these first options, rejecting as false or unimportant, are typically coupled with avoidance, that we stay away from anti-LDS literature. And both options are typically compelled by emotion, often fueled by spiritual evidence, but we don't generally engage in serious examination of the issues on the first two. While our conclusions may be correct, in this case the church is true, the first two options generally reinforce the original belief without an open-minded examination. Now, Latter-day Saints aren't the only ones that resolve matters this way. According to a study from Emory University, for instance, committed Democrats and Republicans both generally rely on emotion rather than reason when evaluating information that challenges their political views. When brain activity was measured from test subjects who were asked to engage or negative information, the circuits involved in the reasoning were not particularly engaged. Instead, the researchers recorded brain activity in the emotional centers of the brain, especially those areas known to be involved in resolving conflict. Once the test subjects had come to the conclusions that fit their underlying beliefs, essentially finding ways to ignore information that could not be rationally discounted, the brain circuits that mediate negative emotions, like sadness and disgust, were turned off, while the circuits involved in behavior, reward, were strongly activated. As one of the researchers explained, everyone from politicians to scientists reason with emotionally based judgments when they have a vested interest in how to interpret the facts. So it's not just Latter-day Saints or religious people. This happens all the time. Now, although we try to defend our beliefs, some Republicans become Democrats and vice versa. Some believers become atheists, and some atheists become believers. Some Mormons become Baptists, some Baptists become Mormons. Some Mormons become critics, and some critics become converts. So people do not necessarily continue to defend a belief when they're faced against what they think is enough evidence to move one way or the other. But critics typically claim that all Latter-day Saints choose one of the less rational options. Why? Because they say that any rational person that reads the supposedly disconfirming evidence would have to conclude that the church is not true, that no rational person could accept that there was angels, gold plates, and so forth. What's interesting is that when these same people are presented with evidence that supports Mormonism, they also tend to take the same less rational approach, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, while it's certainly possible that most or many Mormons brush the stuff aside as first two options, there are rational reasons for believing. All of us, for example, are involved in relationships with spouses, parents, siblings, or offspring, to which we maintain committed relationships despite unsettling information. We tend to recognize that there are long-term benefits to sticking with committed relationships. In spite of the short-term costs, which are sometimes quite high, people committed to their religion accrue benefits such as answers to the meaning of life or a relationship with the divine. Rational people will sacrifice for their religious beliefs when they get more in return. They will even rationalize their behavior and beliefs for some time without a payback. But most of us will not rationalize indefinitely unless our beliefs produce the payback we expect. And many people find that religion does deliver the expected payback. Some members may choose to live with doubt. They may continue to question the truth claims of Mormonism, and put aside the unsettling information in favor of the rewards they find in assembling with the saints. Those, however, who don't put aside their doubts and don't consciously avoid LDS critical material and continue to suffer from cognitive dissonance eventually move into one of the other two options, either changing cognitions or adding cognitions. Changing cognitions or beliefs. Decide that you were wrong about the ball being red. It really is green. Some people can't dismiss doubt-generating discoveries as false and unimportant, and so they feel that there's enough weight, that their sources are credible, and they give up their religion. We're getting anxiety when both cognitions are unevenly balanced, or evenly balanced, rather. We don't know which one to choose, and we have to choose one to alleviate this discomfort, what's called cognitive consonance or thought harmony. When the tension's reduced, we feel better. And it's interesting that a lot of ex-Mormons say that I struggled with these issues, and now that I left the church, I feel so much better. Well, of course, because we resolved the issue. But people that struggle and say, I've come to have a stronger testimony, also feel better. They also have it reduced. Once the discomfort is resolved in their minds and they've made up their mind to exit the church, many members avoid future cognitive dissonance that could come from evidence that favors the church. To alleviate this tension, they generally explain away pro-LDS arguments in the same less too rational ways as members explain anti-Mormon literature. They conclude that their former LDS testimony was either false, perhaps a result of feelings, hope, desire, or confirmation bias, or the testimony is rejected as unimportant. No amount of spiritual testimony can compete with the newly perceived truth of the secular or historical conflicting evidence. Like some of their believing counterparts, they often avoid literature that runs contrary to their belief, or in this case, their unbelief. In other words, they avoid those evidences that strengthen LDS arguments. They often decide from the start that LDS scholarly studies are biased, unreliable, or ineffectual before even reading such material. By disregarding all LDS scholarly studies that challenge their unbelief, they avoid repeating their experience of psychological anxiety. It's fairly common, for instance, to encounter critics who are completely unaware of LDS scholarly studies, but yet they claim that there's no defense for it, that the arguments prove that the church is not true. One anonymous internet posting critic, for example, claimed that the evidence proved that the Book of Mormon was a fraud, while simultaneously admitting that he was completely unfamiliar with the latest scholarly rebuttals to anti-Mormon accusations. Another online critic claimed that he had no intention of reading LDS scholarly arguments because doing so would be an incredible waste of time. He was satisfied, he bragged, that the truth is not found in Mormonism and he had no need to see counter-arguments. They've already concluded the church isn't true. They believe the anti-Mormon claims provide evidence for their conclusions, and they don't want answers when their minds are already made up. Actually, examining pro-LDS arguments could create that cognitive dissonance again. And it's ironic that the critics are usually the ones who claim to be open-minded, in contrast to closed-minded Mormons. Several ex-Mormons, for instance, have said that their opposition to the church is so strong that they would be unwilling to return regardless of any new information that might come forth. According to a 2001 informal poll of nearly 400 ex-members, for example, over half said that nothing could open the door for the return to Mormonism. So, you know, it's ironic that many of these people claim to leave for intellectual reasons, but they refuse to examine LDS intellectual arguments for non-intellectual reasons. It's, again, driven by emotion. Okay, we have the fourth one, adding cognitions or information to validate the original belief. Get another opinion on the color of the ball. Adding supporting information can shift the weight of evidence to tilt in favor of our original beliefs. For example, in the red-green ball instance, if you discover that I was colorblind Your personal belief would again carry more weight, making it easier to choose between my opinion and yours. As one Book of Mormon example, we'll explore the anti-Mormon argument that the Book of Mormon plates, golden plates, are too heavy. They would have weighed over 200 pounds. Joseph Smith couldn't possibly have carried these, let alone run from would-be ambushers when he returned with the plates home. Well, when we add the cognition that the plates were gold in appearance, and that early Mesoamericans used gold-appearing metals, which weighed less than gold because they had other alloys in there, well, we find that the anti-Mormon cognition does not equal or outweigh the pro-Mormon cognition. Adding cognitions typically requires a paradigm shift. We would have to recognize, for example, that gold plates does not mean that they were pure gold. You think about it, many of the people here are wearing probably 14-karat gold wedding rings. Well, that's not pure gold. It's 58% gold, 42% alloys. But we call them gold. And the same thing applies to gold plates. They need not be pure gold to be golden plates. Well, that's a minor paradigm shift. But the same thing is required many times in order to understand other LDS arguments. As I noted earlier, a fundamentalist mindset seems to make believers more vulnerable to testimony damage. Some testimonies, quite frankly, are built on sandy foundations, such as folklore, traditions, or membership based on family pressure. When there's no true conversion of the Spirit, it's difficult to accept those things that must be known on faith alone. Now, members who do have spiritual testimonies, however, are not immune to apostasy. We know from sad experience that some stalwart members, you know, the three witnesses, Oliver Cowdery, some of the eight witnesses, and so forth, they apostatized. Some returned, some did not. But some of these had very distinct and impressive spiritual experiences, and that didn't always stick with them. So nobody's completely immune. We learn from Lehi's vision that some of those who have tasted of the fruit, with God's love, abandon the fruit when pressured from outside influences. There are many complex factors that contribute to each person's reasons for belief or disbelief. I've noticed, however, a few common elements among many of those who leave the church for supposedly intellectual reasons. Generally, those members who had testimony of the church also many times had fundamentalist views about Scripture as well as the manner and role or the nature and role of prophets. These perceptions present themselves as stumbling blocks when they're faced with intellectually challenging issues. Most of us embrace concepts, beliefs, or positions primarily because we've never thought of questioning them. I mean, we can't examine everything that we believe, or otherwise we'd spend our whole day doing this, and we'd never be able to make decisions. We have to, at some point, say, okay, I trust this person, or I believe this, and move forward. So all of us accept things that we haven't fully examined. Now, unfortunately, we occasionally confuse peripheral teachings in the church with rumors, traditions, or personal opinions, and think that they're LDS doctrines, where they're not. Sometimes we're unaware of how to think outside the box of conventional LDS interpretations, even if those interpretations are based on tradition rather than revelation. And we may not know how to handle complex issues. If we build our house of straw on non-doctrinal ideologies and the structure collapses on the sandy foundation of misunderstanding, our entire belief system may crumble as well. We might assume, for example, that all prophets of all ages understood the gospel, doctrines, principles, and practices in the same way. I've had members before the war that think that the Old Testament people, the Book of Mormon people, they were just like the Third Ward down the street. They pretty much, other than the building structures, they pretty much behaved the same way. We may perhaps unconsciously embrace a fundamental and rigid approach to the categorization of people and principles. We may, for example, believe that a prophet is always spiritual, knowledgeable, kind, and disciplined. He could never err on religious matters or hold false beliefs. Sometimes we may unintentionally see things in an unambiguous black and white. Mormons have the truth, others do not. Paying tithing assures financial stability or prosperity. Not paying tithing will lead to financial ruin. The Spirit speaks to Mormons and not to non-Mormons. If you live righteously, your children will all go on missions and get sealed in the temple. If your children astray, or your life is full of problems, you're not living righteously. Such a black and white fundamentalist mindset can set us up for problems. There either were horses in the Book of, or in ancient America, the fundamentalist mind may think, or the Book of Mormon is false. There either was a worldwide flood that wiped out virtually all life, or the Bible is false. To the fundamentalists, there is no middle ground. If they discover what they believe to be persuasive information, that there was no worldwide flood, or that actual horses were absent from the Americas, their entire ideology crumbles beneath them. And when some people become disaffected, even over false assumptions, further enlightenment or counter-evidences may fail to resuscitate the testimony. Not infrequently, we are too quick to uncritically accept the things we hear or read, even from sources such as church leaders or in church magazines. Now, it's not that their words aren't true, because typically they are, but we should use our brains as well as our spirits when we study the gospel. President N. Eldon Tanner reportedly complained about the tendency of church members to read the official magazines with uncritical acceptance, without engaging in the process of thought, judgment, and inspired confirmation that genuine internal dialogue with the written or spoken word makes possible. Too often, we uncritically accept rumors, including faith-promoting rumors, in lieu of facts, traditions, speculation, and opinion in lieu of revelation, and unrealistic expectations and illusions of prophets and scripture in lieu of mature and realistic perspectives. In short, we must recognize the need to open our minds to potentially understand gospel topics in ways we may not have seen them before. Disillusionment, observes psychologist Dr. Wendy Ulrich. Some of you, those of you who attended have heard her speak before. She said this: disillusionment is a very good thing. I do not want to live a life based on illusions, and being disillusioned is very valuable to me. Illusions and misconceptions are straw men. They're easily destroyed by accurate information. Sometimes part of our testimony, as evidenced by the claims of many ex-members, may unknowingly be grounded on illusion and misconceptions. When critical information destroys conclusions based on straw men or false assumptions, some members will lose their entire testimonies. The most common misconceptions that seem to factor into personal apostasy include unrealistic expectations of prophets, confusing tradition with doctrine, imposing our views on others, and unrealistic expectations of science and scholarship. The first one: I make no claim of infallibility, said President Spencer W. Kimball. Harold B. Lee indicated that not every word spoken or written by a general authority need be considered as inspired. And Elder J. Reuben Clark said that even the president of the church has not always spoken under the direction of the Holy Ghost. The purpose and mission of the church is to invite all to come into Christ, DNC 2059. Prophets stand as leaders in this invitation, and the things they say and do as prophets are intended to accomplish this goal. How do we come to Christ? Well, the Book of Mormon gives us the six-point pattern: repentance, baptism, gift of the Holy Ghost, and journey to the end, and being found spotless. This list, in turn, entails personal commitments, attitudes, and relationships with the divine. We must make these personal commitments and interactions with the Lord. Prophets help guide us to the waters of truth, but they cannot drink for us. Guiding us does not mean all their comments are inerrant. They're there to help us, but we have to receive from the fountain, receive our own confirmation, revelation to the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon, of Joseph Smith, or any other doctrine or principle that we want to understand. It's incumbent upon us to seek that out. Ex-members generally claim that the issues such as polygamy, the translation of the Book of Abraham, or Brigham Young's racial views created cognitive dissonance that eventually caused them to leave the church. Usually, however, the actual competing cognitions are generally a set of assumptions or perceptions of what a prophet is and how a prophet should behave, compared with evidence about what the prophet was and how the prophet behaved. One critic, for example, noted his bewilderment at how the Book of Mormon could be a very poorly written text if it were truly dictated from the mouth of an omniscient God. Likewise, he seemed perplexed as to how Brigham Young, who claimed to speak for the same omniscient God, could have fallible thoughts about the cosmos. Another ex-Mormon recently claimed that every last thing that came from Joseph's mouth and or pen should be the universal truth. I mean, it's an incredible statement, but that's how some people view prophets. Do we sometimes fall in that pattern? Do we have members of our family or in our work community that fall into that pattern? That sets them up for problems. Prophets are not born as prophets, and they are not raised in social and cultural vacuums. When they are called as prophets, they don't suddenly become divine. They are still men. Prophets have and are entitled to their own opinions, their own misconceptions, their own bias, and their own mistakes. When a Latter-day Saint is called to be a Relief Society president, an Elders' Quorum president, bishop, stake president, etc., they bring to their calling many of those things which make up their personalities and worldviews, including their strengths, weaknesses, and preconceived ideas. The same can be said for prophets. Gospel education for the prophets and masses is an evolutionary process, the same as any other type of education, hence the need for continuing revelation. Neither complete doctrines nor specific doctrinal details are always revealed at once. As Joseph Smith once said, it is not wisdom that we should have all knowledge at once presented before us, but that we should have a little at a time, then we can comprehend it. As evidenced from the scriptures and restoration accounts, revelation is typically not dispensed as an unsolicited gift from heaven, instead is answered to petitioning God. You think of the first vision, it's because Joseph went and prayed and asked a question. Same thing with the word of wisdom. So many times, same thing with the revelation in 1978, extending the priesthood to all worthy males. It's going to the Lord and asking. Heavenly Father doesn't typically just dump it on us. And of course that applies to all of us, not just the prophets. Confusing tradition with doctrine. Unfortunately, but unavoidably, we and sometimes even prophets confuse tradition-based interpretations with doctrines or official positions. Of the many examples, I'll choose Book of Mormon geography, which we're going to hear about from Larry Paulson a little more. Most members have believed, and perhaps still believe, that the Book of Mormon event took place over the entire hemisphere, North and South America. A cursory reading of the Book of Mormon seems to lead to this conclusion. You've got a land north, a land south, and a little narrow neck of the land joining the two. Sounds convincing. Well, it's likely that Joseph Smith and many of his contemporaries, at least in part, accepted this. There's some evidence that Joseph Smith was open to other views, but it's kind of a tradition that was passed on from generation to generation. It's spoken from the pulpit, included in the manuals, and almost implied as official, even though there is no official position on Book of Mormon geography. And a superficial reading of the Book of Mormon almost leads to this. Plus, we see the same things in the early writings of the saints when they found remnants of Indian bones. Well, if you believe that this was populated by Lamanites and Nephites, what does that come to mind? Well, these have to be the bones of those people. That doesn't mean it was. That's their perception, and we can allow that. And it's not a revealed doctrine. It's a tradition. And, of course, Orson Pratt, you know, helped promote this with his footnotes later on in the Book of Mormon. There were many Latter-day Saints through the years who didn't accept this, and in most recent times, most LDS scholars believe that it took place in a very narrow area, limited area in Mesoamerica, and like we're going to hear more about that later. Now, if we assume that Book of Mormon events actually took place in limited geography, how do we reconcile the fact that past prophets were wrong about the location of the Book of Mormon events or the makeup of pre-Columbian people? It should be remembered that some LDS members didn't accept this, and even some leaders, so it wasn't that it was across the board. We might similarly ask how Old Testament prophets could be wrong about the shape of the earth. In some ways, tradition seems to follow Newton's first law of motion, which states in part that an object in motion tends to stay in motion unless acted upon by extraneous forces. Until some new information unbalances our traditional views and makes us critically examine those views, we generally tend to uncritically accept most traditions, even when they're wrong. Prophets, like other mortals, accept tradition that may be an error simply because they've never thought about challenging the tradition. Sometimes when new light is given, we resist. Most of us are averse to change. After all, we're creatures of habit. Joseph Smith said, "I have tried for a number of years to get the minds of the saints prepared to receive the things of God, but we frequently see some of them, after suffering all they have had for the work of the Lord, will fly to pieces like glass as soon as anything comes that is contrary to their traditions." Well, it really doesn't matter how long or how many people, including prophets, believed in erroneous non-doctrinal idea. Doctrine is not determined by how long something is believed or by the belief's popularity. As English author Gilbert Keith Chesterton once observed, fallacies do not cease to be fallacies because they become fashions. When we recognize that both members and non-members sometimes mistake official LDS doctrines with traditions, procedures, policies, and the presentation of doctrine, many anti-LDS arguments lose what potency they might have had. Imposing our views on others. Our world views, what the Germans refer to as our Weltanschauungs, are a composite of many complex factors, and they're colored by the lenses that we view these through. A lot of times we can't understand. How can this society believe this? How can they logically understand this? Maybe we're comparing it to a foreign society because we see everything from our own glasses. And of course, that's not limited to Mormons or Americans or modern people. For example, while virtually all people see the same colors, different people may conceptualize those colors differently and divide the color continuum into different points. Russians and Americans, for instance, put the dividing line between green and blue at different points. Some hues that we call green, Russians would call blue. Hair color in Arabic is categorized differently than it's English. What they might call blonde, we often call brown or red. In English, you have chips, where we call them French fries. And you know, so you have a variety of things that from different views, you use different words, you see things differently, and we tend to understand them from our view. So if somebody says, you know, chips, you think of Lay's potato chips or something. But depending on where that's coming from, that's not what it might mean. And we run into this problem when we examine the scriptures. Non-LDS Bible scholars, here's a good example. Catch. The word catch could mean catch a fish or catch a nap. Okay, if you don't know the context or understand, you know, it can be confusing. How do you catch a nap in the same way as you catch a fish? Non-LDS Bible scholars Molina and Rohrbaugh explained that all readers must interact with the writing and complete it if it's to make sense. Every written document invites immediate participation on the part of the reader. Thus, writing provides what is necessary but cannot provide everything. Because reading has strong social elements, readers who share an author's social environment are more likely to fill in the blanks with instinctively correct mental pictures culled from their own experiences and culture. Reasonable clarity is enjoyed because of the common social system. Now, when our social system of the reader and writer is different, which is typically the case when you read an ancient text or a foreign text or both, the mental pictures that we readers unconsciously conjure may be drastically different from what the writer was pretending to portray. When the reader-writer come from different social systems, then as a rule, non-understanding, or at best misunderstanding, will be the result. Generally, a reader's mental image, especially the image conjured by an uninformed reader, will be influenced by his own culture. And they call that recontextualization. We put in our own context. And this problem helps us recognize some of the important things that are different in the scriptures. In the Bible, for example, we frequently find reference to the whole earth. When we hear this phrase, as 21st century Americans, we think of the planet, the globe, it's the whole earth. Well, ancient people didn't view it that way. They didn't envision it in the same kind of plan as we do now. To the people of the Bible, the whole earth generally referred to the inhabited lands of which they knew. This was their world. In Exodus 10:12, for instance, we read that the Lord caused the land of Egypt to be swarmed by locusts. In verse 15, we read that the locusts covered the face of the whole earth. Well, he's telling us what whole earth refers to there. It's the land of Egypt. In Luke 2:1, we read that Caesar Augustus sent a decree to all the world, a tax decree. Well, do you think he really sent a tax decree to the Americas, to Europe, Asia, everywhere? No, it's to all the world that he knew. Well, if we understand the ancient use of earth, that was a localized area, that helps us understand the Book of Mormon's use of the same term. And when we try to understand LDS events and Book of Mormon events as real people that happen in real time, a lot of these arguments, again, lose what potency they might have had. Running short on time here, I'll try to zip through these. Unrealistic expectations of science and scholarship. We know that science and scholarship, some people think that Mormons are anti-science or anti-scholarship, and that couldn't be further from the truth, although some members might be. Joseph Smith said, one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may. We should gather all the truth and true principles in the world and treasure them up, or we shall not come out as Mormons. Truth is truth. We should look for it in whatever we can. Now, despite the claims of some critics, DNA science and archaeology are too limited to damage histories through the Book of Mormon. We don't have time to go on that today. There's some of my book. There's some of the FAIR website. You can look it up. History is another area that presents problems. In fact, it's main area. And critics always claim that Mormons are biased, and we put a spin on things. And then they turn around and say, we're not Mormons, and so we're objective. Okay? You're not objective because you have a vested interest. We're objective. And so you should trust our sources better than your own sources that you have. Well, nobody's biased. Nobody's able to completely divest themselves of bias and ideologies. Bias is at the heart of how we understand arguments, the hinge that we use to determine the evidence for the arguments. Our perceptions or how we understand things are always colored by a variety of factors that tie into our bias. The late scientist and philosopher Thomas Kuhn, for example, taught that scientific communities have paradigms or a constellation of beliefs, and that it takes sometimes a major shift in paradigm, a revolution, as he calls it, for people to move out of these things, because otherwise they're, again, looking through these colored glasses. David Hackett Fisher, a non-Mormon history professor at Brandeis, says the Baconian fallacy consists in the idea that a historian can operate without the aid of preconceived questions, hypotheses, ideas, assumptions, etc. Another quote here from Stephen Best. He says that every vision of history functions as a specific lens or optic, and he notes that the lens is limiting. It's not only magnifies, but it limits and prevents some things to do. And we're going to quote one of our favorite critics, and it's actually a guy that I get along with on a personal level very well, Dan Vogel, and he's more upfront with the bias than a lot of critics, and I have to give him credit for that. He says here, once an historian, and I've lost my place here, so I'll just read it from the screen. Once an historian decides that traditional LDS accounts have no historical basis, then Smith's claims about the angel and the gold plates cannot be taken to face value. But that's after you decide. My inclination is to interpret any claim of the paranormal as delusion or fraud. For him, there can be no communication from God. There can be no scripture. He also wrote, to take Joseph Smith at his word, I would have to believe the Book of Mormon is historical, but I don't. If the Book of Mormon is not historical, then what was Joseph Smith about? For those like himself, it's not a question of, is the Book of Mormon true? It's not true, so what factors influenced it? Okay, last one here. Inoculation. While adding cognitions may salvage damage testimonies, a change in paradigms before encountering challenging issues can serve as an inoculation for shaken faith syndrome. And you think about inoculation, it protects people against diseases, but there's always a few people that it can hurt. And so we run into that problem even with trying to inoculate members against some of these anti-Mormon claims. Dan Peterson, on one of the message boards years ago, he gave a good example from a talk he heard from Stanley Kimball. He spoke of three levels of Mormon history. Level A, he said, is a Sunday school version. Everything is good, harmonious. Level B is the anti-Mormon version. Everything is just the opposite. It's all bad. And he says the church typically tries to keep people on level A. Well, there's a level C that is a synthesis of the two. It's pretty much like A, but it exposes all the rest of the stuff. The problem is that for somebody to move to C, they have to be exposed by B. And for some people, that can cause testimony damage. So it's a challenging issue of how to teach people about the rest of the nuances out there without hurting a testimony. But people that move to C usually keep their testimony intact and have a richer understanding of their beliefs as well. The biggest problem with adding cognition is that most members remain ignorant of LDS scholarship and apologetic responses. Scott already mentioned we're poor at fundraising, and of course the funds would help spread the word, and that's the main problem. You know, many members have heard of Farms and Fair, but you know, how many people really know a lot about it? How many people know of Hugh Nibley, even outside of this room? A lot of people, but how many people have actually read his material? That's different. So there's a struggle, and that's our main challenge, is try to get the word out there. I hope that our efforts can see an increase in the recognition that more and more members will be made aware of Fair and Farms and scholarly evidences in favor of Joseph Smith. As Sir Francis Bacon said, and I'm going to probably destroy the Latin, ipsa scientia potestas est, which means basically knowledge is power. And I thank you. When encountering critics of the church, how do you determine whether or not it is worth your while to defend the faith, and where do you draw the line? Most critics, in my experience, are closed-minded to begin with. And that's really true. Years ago, I used to get more on the message boards and try to debate the critics, and I found that pointless. Basically, it's a matter of determining, does this person really have questions, or are they just wanting to argue? And if there's really questions, then I'm willing to engage in a discussion. If they just are trying to score points, then it's not worth my time. I have more important things to do. Thus far, as far as I'm aware, education on how to respond to anti-Mormon literature is not a part of the CES system or missionary training. With increased use of the internet, how do you expect this to change? Richard Bushman gave a seminar on apologetics to several people from the CES system. Scott Gordon was there, and I think some other fair members that shared some ideas. So I think there's some effort from the church to teach the members through channels about some of these more difficult issues. When will your talk be available? It's available in book form at the back of the conference right now. When should we begin to inoculate a member? When, under what circumstances? That's a tough one. I think that, you know, the saying is that sunshine is the best disinfectant. We need to, I think, start teaching members. The problem is that some people like to throw out these interesting things for shock value. Even members do. I've seen that sometimes in Elders' Quorum or Sunday School. It's like, hey, did you know that Joseph Smith had so many wives, etc.? And they do it just to, you know, make themselves look good or as a shock value. We need to be sensitive that we cannot be participants in damages in anybody's testimony. And so anything that is controversial that we present, we really should try to expose those things in a faithful context. And so it's rewarding and enriching rather than damaging. So what is the true color of the ball? Purple, I guess. When the prophet speaks, the debate is done. And that's from an old era thing. When the president speaks, the thinking has been done. It's been repudiated by, I can't even remember now, my mind's gone blank, but there's a dialogue article about it. That's not the position of the church. The church, and there's several quotes in my book that talk about that the brethren expect us to think for ourselves, and the Lord expects us to think for ourselves. You think of Lehi's vision. Okay, he had his vision, and then his sons asked what happened, but what did Nephi do? He didn't just ask about the vision. What did he do? He went to the Lord himself. He says, help me understand this. Okay, that should be our example. We get stuff from General Conference, from the brethren, then we're supposed to go to the Lord and receive our own confirmation and understand ourselves. Thank you.
Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help increase the popularity of this podcast by rating it in iTunes. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Lawrence Green. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair.